holidays, they were hanging out with one another, and I couldn't visit. Soweto was a 40-minute drive from my house. We didn't have money for petrol. After school, I was on my own. Weekends, I was on my own. Ever the outsider, I created my own strange little world. I did it out of necessity. I needed a way to fit in. I also needed money, a way to buy the same snacks and do the things that the other kids were doing, which is how I became the tuck shop guy. Thanks to my long walk to school, I was late every single day. I'd have to stop off in the prefect's office to write my name down for detention. I was the patron saint of detention. Already late, I'd run to join my morning classes, math, English, biology, whatever. The last period before break was assembly. The pupils would come together in the assembly hall, each grade seated row by row, and the teachers and the prefects would get up on stage and go over the business of what was happening in the school, announcements, awards, that sort of thing. The names of the kids with detention were announced at every assembly, and I was always one of them. Always. Every single day. It was a running joke. The prefect would say, "Detentions for today," and I would stand up automatically. It was like the Oscars, and I was Meryl Streep. There was one time I stood up, and then the prefect named the five people, and I wasn't one of them. Everyone burst out laughing. Somebody yelled out, "Where's Trevor?" The prefect looked at the paper and shook his head. Nope. The entire hall erupted with cheers and applause. Yeah! Then, immediately after assembly, there would be a race to the tuck shop, because the queue to buy food was so long. Every minute you spent in the queue was working against your break time. The sooner you got your food, the longer you had to eat, play a game of soccer, or hang out. Also, if you got there late, the best food was gone. Two things were true about me at that age. One, I was still the fastest kid in school. And two, I had no pride. The second we were dismissed from assembly, I would run like a bat out of hell to the tuck shop so I could be the first one there. I was always first in line. I became notorious for being that guy. So much so that people started coming up to me in line. "Hey, can you buy this for me?" Which would piss off the kids behind me, because it was basically cutting the line. So people started approaching me during assembly. They'd say, "Hey, I've got 10 rand. If you buy my food for me, I'll give you 2. That's when I learned, time is money. I realized people would pay me to buy their food because I was willing to run for it. I started telling everyone at assembly, "Place your orders. Give me a list of what you want. Give me a percentage of what you're going to spend, and I'll buy your food for you." I was an overnight success. Fat guys were my number one customers. They loved food, but couldn't run. I had all these rich, fat, white kids who were like, "This is fantastic. My parents spoiled me, I've got money, and now I've got a way I can get food without having to work for it. And I still get my break." I had so many customers, I was turning kids away. I had a rule. I would take 5 orders a day. High bidders only. I'd make so much that I could buy my lunch using other kids' money and keep the lunch money my mom gave me for pocket cash. Then I could afford to catch a bus home instead of walking, or save up to buy whatever. Every day I'd take orders, assembly would end, and I'd make my mad dash and buy everybody's hot dogs and cokes and muffins. If you paid me extra, you could even tell me where you'd be and I'd deliver it to you. I'd found my niche. Since I belonged to no group, I learned to move seamlessly between groups. I floated. I was a chameleon. Still a cultural chameleon. I learned how to blend. I could play sports with the jocks. I could talk computers with the nerds. I could jump in the circle and dance with the township kids. I popped around to everyone, working, chatting, telling jokes, making deliveries. I was like a weed dealer, but of food. The weed guy is always welcome at the party. He's not a part of the circle, but he's invited into the circle temporarily because of what he can offer. That's who I was. Always an outsider. As the outsider, you can retreat into a shell, be anonymous, be invisible. Or you can go the other way. You protect yourself by opening up. You don't ask to be accepted for everything you are, just the one part of yourself that you're willing to share. For me, it was humor. I learned that even though I didn't belong to one group, I could be a part of any group that was laughing. I'd drop in, pass out the snacks, tell a few jokes. I'd perform for them. I'd catch a bit of their conversation, learn more about their group, and then leave. I never overstayed my welcome. I wasn't popular, but I wasn't an outcast. I was everywhere with everybody, and at the same time, I was all by myself. I don't regret anything I've ever done in life, any choice that I've made. But I'm consumed with regret for the things I didn't do, the choices I didn't make, the things I didn't say. We spend so much time being afraid of failure, afraid of rejection. But regret is the thing we should fear most. Failure is an answer. Rejection is an answer. Regret is an eternal question you will never have the answer to. What if? If only. I wonder what would have. You will never, never know, and it will haunt you for the rest of your days. 12. A young man's long, awkward, occasionally tragic, and frequently humiliating education in affairs of the heart, part 2, The Crush. In high school, the attention of girls was not an affliction I suffered from. I wasn't the hot guy in class. I wasn't even the cute guy in class. I was ugly. Puberty was not kind to me. My acne was so bad that people used to ask what was wrong with me, like I'd had an allergic reaction to something. It was the kind of acne that qualifies as a medical condition. Acne vulgaris, the doctor called it. We're not talking about pimples, kids. We're talking pustules. Big, pus-filled blackheads and whiteheads. They started on my forehead, spread down the sides of my face, and covered my cheeks and neck and ravaged me everywhere. Being poor didn't help. Not only could I not afford a decent haircut, leaving me with a huge, unruly afro, but my mother also used to get angry at the fact that I grew out of my school uniforms too fast. So to save money, she started buying my clothes 3 sizes too big. My blazer was too long, and my pants were too baggy, and my shoes flopped around. I was a clown. And of course, Murphy's Law, the year my mom started buying my clothes too big, was the year that I stopped growing. So now, I was never going to grow into my clown clothes, and I was stuck being a clown. The only thing I had going for me was the fact that I was tall. But even there, I was gangly and awkward-looking. Duck feet, high ass, nothing worked. After suffering my Valentine's Day heartbreak at the hands of Maylene and the handsome, charming Lorenzo, I learned a valuable lesson about dating. What I learned was that cool guys get girls, and funny guys get to hang out with the cool guys with their girls. I was not a cool guy. Therefore, I did not have girls. I understood that formula very quickly, and I knew my place. I didn't ask girls out. I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't even try. For me to try to get a girl would have upset the natural order of things. Part of my success as the tuck shop guy was that I was welcome everywhere, and I was welcome everywhere because I was nobody. I was the acne-ridden clown with duck feet and floppy shoes. I wasn't a threat to the guys. I wasn't a threat to the girls. The minute I became somebody, I risked no longer being welcomed as nobody. The pretty girls were already spoken for. The popular guys had staked their claim. They would say, "I like Zuleika." And you knew that meant if you tried anything with Zuleika, there'd be a fight. In the interest of survival, the smart move was to stay on the fringe, stay out of trouble. At Sandringham, the only time girls in class looked at me was when they wanted me to pass a letter to the hot guy in class. But there was one girl I knew named Joanna. Joanna and I had been at the same school intermittently our whole lives. We were in preschool at Maryvale together. Then she left and went to another school. Then we were in primary school at H.A. Jack together. Then she left and went to another school. Then finally, we were at Sandringham together. Because of that, we became friends. Joanna was one of the popular girls. Her best friend was Zahira. Joanna was beautiful. Zahira was stunning. Zahira was colored, Cape Malay. She looked like Salma Hayek. Joanna was out and about and kissing boys, so the guys were all into her. Zahira, as beautiful as she was extremely shy, so there weren't as many guys after her. Joanna and Zahira were always together. They were one grade below me, but in terms of popularity, they were three grades above me. Still, I got to hang out with them because I knew Joanna, and we had this thing from being in different schools together. Dating girls may have been out of the question for me, but talking to them was not, because I could make them laugh. Human beings like to laugh, and lucky for me, pretty girls are human beings. So I could relate to them in that way, but never in the other way. I knew this because whenever they stopped laughing at my jokes and stories, they'd say, "So, how do you think I can get Daniel to ask me out?" I always had a clear idea of where I stood. Outwardly, I had carefully cultivated my status as the funny, non-threatening guy. But secretly, I had the hugest crush on Zahira. She was so pretty and so funny. We'd hang out and have great conversations. I thought about her constantly. But for the life of me, I never considered myself worthy of dating her. I told myself, I'm going to have a crush on her forever, and that's all that's ever going to happen. At a certain point, I decided to map out a strategy. I decided I'd be best friends with Zahira and stay friends with her long enough to ask her to the matric dance, what we call our senior prom. Mind you, we were in grade 9 at this point. The matric dance was 3 years away. But I decided to play the long game. I was like, yep, just gonna take my time. Because that's what happens in the movies, right? I'd seen my American high school movies. You hang around long enough as the friendly good guy, and the girl dates a bunch of handsome jerks, and then one day she turns around and goes, "Oh, it's you. It was always you. You're the guy I was supposed to be with all along." That was my plan. It was foolproof. I hung out with Zahira every chance I got. We'd talk about boys, which ones she liked, and which ones liked her. I'd give her advice. At one point, she got set up with this guy, Gary. They started dating. Gary was in the popular group, but kind of shy, and Zahira was in the popular group, but kind of shy. So his friends and her friends set them up together, like an arranged marriage. But Zahira didn't like Gary at all. She told me. We talked about everything. One day, I don't know how, but I plucked up the courage to ask Zahira for her phone number, which was a big deal back then, because it wasn't like cell phone numbers where everybody has everyone's number for texting and everything. This was the landline to her house, where her parents might answer. We were talking one afternoon at school and I asked, "Can I get your phone number? Maybe I can call you and we can talk at home sometime." She said yes, and my mind exploded. What? A girl is giving me her phone number? This is insane. What do I do? I was so nervous. I'll never forget her telling me the digits one by one as I wrote them down, trying to keep my hand from shaking. We said goodbye and went our separate ways to class. And I was like, okay, Trevor, play it cool. Don't call her right away. I called her that night at 7. She'd given me her number at 2. That was me being cool. Dude, don't call her at 5. That's too obvious. Call her at 7. I phoned her house that night. Her mom answered. I said, "May I speak to Zahira, please?" Her mom called her and she came to the phone. And we talked. For like an hour. After that, we started talking more. At school, on the phone. I never told her how I felt. Never made a move. Nothing. I was always too scared. Zahira and Gary broke up. Then they got back together. Then they broke up. Then they got back together. They kissed once, but she didn't like it, so they never kissed again. Then, they broke up for real. I bided my time through it all. I watched popular Gary go down in flames, and I was still the good friend. Yep, the plan is working. Matric dance, here we come. Only 2.5 years to go. Then, we had the mid-year school holidays. The day we came back, Zahira wasn't at school. Then she wasn't at school the next day. Then, she wasn't at school the day after that. Eventually, I went and tracked down Joanna on the quad. "Hey, where's Zahira?" I said. "She hasn't been around for a while. Is she sick?" "No," she said. "Didn't anyone tell you? She left the school. She doesn't go here anymore." "What?" "Yeah, she left." My first thought was, wow, okay, that's news. I should give her a call to catch up. What school did she move to? I asked. She didn't. Her dad got a job in America. During the break, they moved there. They've emigrated.
What?
Yeah, she's gone. She was such a good friend, too. I'm really sad. Are you as sad as I am?
Yeah,
I said, still trying to process everything. I liked Zahira. She was really cool. Yeah, she was super sad, too, because she had such a huge crush on you. She was always waiting for you to ask her out. Okay, I gotta go to class. Bye. She ran off and left me standing there, stunned. She'd hit me with so much information at once. First, that Zahira was gone. Then, that she had left for America. And then, that she'd liked me all along. It was like I had been hit by three successive waves of heartbreak, each one bigger than the last. My mind raced through all the hours we'd spent talking on the quad, on the phone. All the times I could have said, "Hey, Zahira, I like you. Will you be my girlfriend?" 10 words that might have changed my life if I'd had the courage to say them. But I hadn't. And now she was gone. In every nice neighborhood, there's one white family that does not give a fuck. You know the family I'm talking about. They don't do their lawn, don't paint the fence, don't fix the roof. Their house is shit. My mom found that house and bought it, which is how she snuck a black family into a place as white as Highlands North. Most black people integrating into white suburbs were moving to places like Bramley and Lombardy East. But for some reason, my mom chose Highlands North. It was a suburban area, lots of shopping, working people mostly. Not wealthy, but stable and middle class. Older houses, but still a nice place to live. In Soweto, I was the only white kid in the black township. In Eden Park, I was the only mixed kid in the colored area. In Highlands North, I was the only black kid in the white suburb. And by only, I mean only. In Highlands North, the white never took flight. It was a largely Jewish neighborhood, and Jewish people don't flee. They're done fleeing. They've already fled. They get to a place, build their shul, and hold it down. Since the white people around us weren't leaving, there weren't a lot of families like ours moving in behind us. I didn't make any friends in Highlands North for the longest time. I had an easier time making friends in Eden Park, to be honest. In the suburbs, everyone lived behind walls. The white neighborhoods of Johannesburg were built on white fear, fear of black crime, fear of black uprisings and reprisals. And as a result, virtually every house sits behind a 6-foot wall, and on top of that wall is electric wire. Everyone lives in a plush, fancy maximum security prison. There is no sitting on the front porch, no saying hi to the neighbors, no kids running back and forth between houses. I'd ride my bike around the neighborhood for hours without seeing a single kid. I'd hear them, though. They were all meeting up behind brick walls for play dates I wasn't invited to. I'd hear people laughing and playing, and I'd get off my bike and creep up and peek over the wall and see a bunch of white kids splashing around in someone's swimming pool. I was like a peeping Tom, but for friendship. It was only after a year or so that I figured out the key to making black friends in the suburbs: the children of domestics. Many domestic workers in South Africa, when they get pregnant, they get fired. Or if they're lucky, the family they work for lets them stay on and they can have the baby. But then the baby goes back to live with the relatives in the homelands. Then the black mother raises the white children, seeing her own child only once a year at the holidays. But a handful of families would let their domestics keep their children with them, living in little maids' quarters or flatlets in the backyard. For a long time, those kids were my only friends. 13. Colorblind. At Sandringham, I got to know this one kid, Teddy. Funny guy, charming as hell. My mom used to call him Bugs Bunny. He had a cheeky smile with two big teeth that stuck out the front of his mouth. Teddy and I got along like a house on fire. One of those friends where you start hanging out and from that day forward you're never apart. We were both naughty as shit, too. With Teddy, I'd finally met someone who made me feel normal. I was the terror in my family. He was the terror in his family. When you put us together, it was mayhem. Walking home from school, we'd throw rocks through windows just to see them shatter, and then we'd run away. We got detention together all the time. The teachers, the pupils, the principal, everyone at school knew Teddy and Trevor, thick as thieves. Teddy's mom worked as a domestic for a family in Linksfield, a wealthy suburb near school. Linksfield was a long walk from my house, nearly 40 minutes, but still doable. Walking around was pretty much all I did back then anyway. I couldn't afford to do anything else, and I couldn't afford to get around any other way. If you liked walking, you were my friend. Teddy and I walked all over Johannesburg together. I'd walk to Teddy's house, and we'd hang out there. Then we'd walk back to my house and hang out there. We'd walk from my house down to the city center, which was like a 3-hour hike just to hang out. And then we'd walk all the way back. Friday and Saturday nights, we'd walk to the mall and hang out. The Balfour Park shopping mall was a few blocks from my house. It's not a big mall, but it has everything. An arcade, a cinema, restaurants, South Africa's version of Target, South Africa's version of The Gap. Then, once we were at the mall, since we never had any money to shop or watch movies or buy food, we'd just wander around inside. One night, we were at the mall, and most of the shops were closed, but the cinema was still showing movies, so the building was still open. There was the stationery shop that sold greeting cards and magazines, and it didn't have a door, so when it closed at night, there was only a metal gate, like a trellis, that was pulled across the entrance and padlocked. Walking past the shop, Teddy and I realized that if we put our arms through the trellis, we could reach this rack of chocolates just inside. And these weren't just any chocolates. They were alcohol-filled chocolates. I loved alcohol. Loved, loved, loved it. My whole life, I'd steal sips of grown-ups' drinks whenever I could. We reached in, grabbed a few, drank the liquor inside, and then gobbled down the chocolates. We'd hit the jackpot. We started going back again and again to steal more. We'd wait for the shops to start to close. Then we'd go and sit against the gate, acting like we were just hanging out. We'd check to make sure the coast was clear, and then one of us would reach in, grab a chocolate, and drink the whiskey. Reach in, grab a chocolate, drink the rum. Reach in, grab a chocolate, drink the brandy. We did this every weekend for at least a month, having the best time. Then we pushed our luck too far. It was a Saturday night. We were hanging out at the entrance to the stationery shop, leaning up against the gate. I reached in to grab a chocolate, and at that exact moment, a mall cop came around the corner and saw me with my arm in up to my shoulder. I brought my hand out with a bunch of chocolates in it. It was almost like a movie. I saw him. He saw me. His eyes went wide. I tried to walk away, acting natural. Then he shouted out, "Hey, stop!" And the chase was on. We bolted, heading for the doors. I knew if a guard cut us off at the exit, we'd be trapped. So we were hauling ass as fast as we could. We cleared the exit. The second we hit the parking lot, mall cops were coming at us from every direction. A dozen of them, at least. I was running with my head down. These guards knew me. I was in that mall all the time. The guards knew my mom, too. She did her banking at that mall. If they even caught a glimpse of who I was dead. We ran straight across the parking lot, ducking and weaving between parked cars. The guards, right behind us, yelling. We made it to the petrol station out at the road, ran through there, and hooked left up the main road. They chased and chased, and we ran and ran, and it was awesome. The risk of getting caught was half the fun of being naughty. And now, the chase was on. I was loving it. I was shitting myself, but also loving it. This was my turf. This was my neighborhood. You couldn't catch me in my neighborhood. I knew every alley and every street, every back wall to climb over, every fence with a gap big enough to slip through. I knew every shortcut you could possibly imagine. As a kid, wherever I went, whatever building I was in, I was always plotting my escape. You know, in case shit went down. In reality, I was a nerdy kid with almost no friends. But in my mind, I was an important and dangerous man who needed to know where every camera was and where all the exit points were. I knew we couldn't run forever. We needed a plan. As Teddy and I booked past the fire station, there was a road off to the left, a dead end that ran into a metal fence. I knew that there was a hole in the fence to squeeze through, and on the far side was an empty field behind the mall that took you back to the main road and back to my house. A grown-up couldn't fit through the hole, but a kid could. All my years of imagining the life of a secret agent for myself finally paid off. Now that I needed an escape, I had one. "Teddy, this way!" I yelled. "No, it's a dead end. We can get through. Follow me." He didn't. I turned and ran into the dead end. Teddy broke the other way. Half the mall cops followed him, half followed me. I got to the fence and knew exactly how to squirm through. Head, then shoulder, one leg, then twist, then the other leg, done. I was through. The guards hit the fence behind me and couldn't follow. I ran across the field to a fence on the far side, popped through there, and then I was right on the road, 3 blocks from my house. I slipped my hands into my pockets and casually walked home. Another harmless pedestrian out for a stroll. Once I got back to my house, I waited for Teddy. He didn't show up. I waited 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour. No Teddy. Fuck. I ran to Teddy's house in Linksfield. No Teddy. Monday morning, I went to school. Still no Teddy. Fuck. Now I was worried. After school, I went home and checked at my house again. Nothing. Teddy's house again. Nothing. Then I ran back home. An hour later, Teddy's parents showed up. My mom greeted them at the door. "Teddy's been arrested for shoplifting," they said. Fuck! I eavesdropped on their whole conversation from the other room. From the start, my mom was certain I was involved. "Well, where was Trevor?" she asked. "Teddy said he wasn't with Trevor," they said. My mom was skeptical. "Are you sure Trevor wasn't involved?" "No, apparently not. The cops said there was another kid, but he got away." "So it was Trevor?" "No, we asked Teddy, and he said it wasn't Trevor. He said it was some other kid."
"Huh, okay."
My mom called me in.
"Do you know about this thing?"
"What thing?"
"Teddy was caught shoplifting."
"What?" I played dumb.
"No, that's crazy. I can't believe it. Teddy? No."
"Where were you?" my mom asked.
"I was at home."
"But you're always with Teddy." I shrugged. "Not on this occasion, I suppose." For a moment, my mom thought she'd caught me red-handed, but Teddy had given me a solid alibi. I went back to my room, thinking I was in the clear. The next day, I was in class, and my name was called over the PA system. "Trevor Noah, report to the principal's office." All the kids were like, "Ooh." The announcements could be heard in every classroom. So now, collectively, the whole school knew I was in trouble. I got up and walked to the office and waited anxiously on an uncomfortable wooden bench outside the door. Finally, the principal, Mr. Friedman, walked out. "Trevor, come in." Waiting inside his office was the head of mall security, 2 uniformed police officers, and my and Teddy's homeroom teacher, Mrs. Foster. A room full of silent, stone-faced white authority figures stood over me, the guilty young black man. My heart was pounding. I took a seat. "Trevor, I don't know if you know any of this," Mr. Friedman said, "but Teddy was arrested the other day."
"What?"
I played the whole thing again.
"Teddy? Oh no. What for?"
"For shoplifting. He's been expelled and he won't be coming back to school. We know there was another boy involved, and these officers are going around to the schools in the area to investigate. We called you here because Mrs. Foster tells us you're Teddy's best friend, and we want to know, do you know anything about this?" I shook my head.
"No, I don't know anything.
Do you know who Teddy was with?
No.
Okay. He stood up and walked over to a television in the corner of the room. Trevor, the police have video footage of the whole thing. We'd like you to take a look.
Fuck!
My heart was pounding in my chest. Well, life, it's been fun, I thought. I'm going to get expelled. I'm going to go to jail. This is it. Mr. Friedman pressed play on the VCR. The tape started. It was grainy, black and white security camera footage, but you could see what was happening plain as day. They even had it from multiple angles. Me and Teddy reaching through the gate. Me and Teddy racing for the door. They had the whole thing. After a few seconds, Mr. Friedman reached up and paused it with me from a few meters out, freeze-framed in the middle of the screen. In my mind, this was when he was going to turn to me and say, "Now, would you like to confess?" He didn't. "Trevor," he said, "do you know of any white kids that Teddy hangs out with?" I nearly shat myself.
What?
I looked at the screen and I realized Teddy was dark. I am light. I have olive skin, but the camera can't expose for light and dark at the same time. So when you put me on a black and white screen next to a black person, the camera doesn't know what to do. If the camera has to pick, it picks me as white. My color gets blown out. In this video, there was a black person and a white person. But still, it was me. The picture wasn't great and my facial features were a bit blurry, but if you looked closely, it was me. I was Teddy's best friend. I was Teddy's only friend. I was the single most likely accomplice. You had to at least suspect that it was me. They didn't. They grilled me for a good 10 minutes, but only because they were so sure that I had to know who this white kid was. "Trevor, you're Teddy's best friend. Tell us the truth. Who is this kid?" "I don't know." "You don't recognize him at all?"
"No."
"Teddy never mentioned him to you?"
"Never."
At a certain point, Mrs. Forster just started running through a list of all the white kids she thought it could be.
"Is it David?"
"No."
"Rian?"
"No."
"Frederick?"
"No." I kept waiting for it to be a trick, for them to turn and say, "It's you!" They didn't. At a certain point, I felt so invisible, I almost wanted to take credit. I wanted to jump up and point at the TV and say, "Are you people blind? That's me! Can you not see that that's me?" But of course, I didn't. And they couldn't. These people had been so fucked by their own construct of race that they could not see that the white person they were looking for was sitting right in front of them. Eventually, they sent me back to class. I spent the rest of the day and the next couple of weeks waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for my mom to get the call. "We've got him! We figured it out!" But the call never came. South Africa has 11 official languages. After democracy came, people said, "Okay, how do we create order without having different groups feel like they've been left out of power again?" English is the international language and the language of money and of the media, so we had to keep that. Most people were forced to learn at least some Afrikaans, so it's useful to keep that too. Plus, we didn't want the white minority to feel ostracized in the new South Africa, or else they'd take all their money and leave. Of the African languages, Zulu has the largest number of native speakers, but we couldn't keep that without also having Xhosa and Tswana and Ndebele. There's also Swazi, Tsonga, Venda, Sotho, and Pedi. We tried to keep all the major groups happy, so the next thing we knew, we'd made 11 languages official languages. And those are just the languages big enough to demand recognition. There are dozens more. It's the Tower of Babel in South Africa. Every single day, every day, you see people completely lost, trying to have conversations and having no idea what the other person is saying. Zulu and Tswana are fairly common. Tsonga and Pedi are pretty fringe. The more common your tongue, the less likely you are to learn others. The more fringe, the more likely you are to pick up two or three. In the cities, most people speak at least some English and usually a bit of Afrikaans, enough to get around. You'll be at a party with a dozen people where bits of conversation are flying by in two or three different languages. You'll miss parts of it. Someone might translate on the fly to give you the gist. You pick up the rest from the context and you just figure it out. The crazy thing is that somehow it works. Society functions, except when it doesn't. 14. A young man's long, awkward, occasionally tragic, and frequently humiliating education in affairs of the heart. Part 3. The dance. By the end of high school, I'd become a mogul. My tuck shop business had evolved into a mini empire that included selling pirated CDs I'd made at home. I'd convinced my mother, as frugal as she was, that I needed a computer for school. I didn't. I wanted it so I could surf the internet and play Leisure Suit Larry. But I was very convincing, and she broke down and got it for me. Thanks to the computer, the internet, and the fortunate gift of a CD writer from a friend, I was in business. I had carved out my niche and was having a great time. Life was so good as an outsider that I didn't even think about dating. The only girls in my life were the naked ones on my computer. While I downloaded music and messed around in chat rooms, I'd dabble in porn sites, here and there. No video, of course, only pictures. With online porn today, you just drop straight into the madness. But with dial-up, it took so long for the images to load. It was almost gentlemanly compared to now. You'd spend a good 5 minutes looking at her face, getting to know her as a person. Then, a few minutes later, you'd get some boobs. By the time you got to her vagina, you'd spent a lot of quality time together. In September of grade 12, the matric dance was coming up. Senior prom. This was the big one. I was again faced with the dilemma of Valentine's Day, confronting another strange ritual I did not understand. All I knew about prom was that, according to my American movies, prom is where it happens. You lose your virginity. You go and you ride in the limousine, and then you and the girl do the thing. That was literally my only reference. But I knew the rule. Cool guys get the girls, and funny guys get to hang out with the cool guys with the girls. I'd assumed I wouldn't be going, or if I did go, it wouldn't be with a date. I had two middlemen working for me in my CD business, Bongani and Tom. They sold the CDs that I copied in exchange for a cut. I met Tom at the arcade at the Balfour Park Mall. Like Teddy, he lived nearby because his mom was a domestic worker. Tom was in my grade but went to a government school, Northview, a proper ghetto school. Tom handled my CD sales over there. Tom was a chatterbox, hyperactive and go, go, go. He was a real hustler too, always trying to cut a deal, work an angle. He could get people to do anything. A great guy, but fucking crazy and a complete liar as well. I went with him once to Hammanskraal, a settlement that was like a homeland, but not really. Hammanskraal, as its Afrikaans name suggests, was the kraal of Haman, what used to be a white man's farm. The proper homelands, Venda and Gazankulu and Transkei, were places where black people actually lived, and the government drew a border around them and said, "Stay there." Hammanskraal and settlements like it were empty places on the map where deported black people had been relocated. That's what the government did. They would find some patch of arid, dusty, useless land and dig row after row of holes in the ground, 1,000 latrines to serve 4,000 families. Then they'd forcibly remove people from illegally occupying some white area and drop them off in the middle of nowhere with some pallets of plywood and corrugated iron. "Here, this is your new home. Build some houses. Good luck." We'd watch it on the news. It was like some heartless survival-based reality TV show. Only nobody won any money. One afternoon in Hammanskraal, Tom told me we were going to see a talent show. At the time, I had a pair of Timberland boots I'd bought. They were the only decent pair of clothing I owned. Back then, almost no one in South Africa had Timberlands. They were impossible to get, but everyone wanted them because American rappers wore them. I'd scrimped and saved my tuck shop money and my CD money to buy them. As we were leaving, Tom told me, "Be sure to wear your Timberlands." The talent show was in this little community hall, attached to nothing in the middle of nowhere. When we got there, Tom was going around, shaking hands, chatting with everybody. There was singing, dancing, some poetry. Then the host got up on stage and said,
"Renali moderagatsi, yo o khetigileng. Kakopo amogelang spliffsta.
We've got a special performer, a rapper all the way from America. Please welcome Spliffsta." Spliffsta was Busta Rhymes' hype man at the time. I sat there confused. What? Spliffsta? In Hammanskraal? Then everyone in the room turned and looked at me. Tom walked over and whispered in my ear,
"Dude, come up on stage."
"What?"
"Come on stage."
"Dude, what are you talking about?"
"Dude, please. You're gonna get me in so much shit. They've already paid me the money."
Money? What money? Of course, what Tom had failed to tell me was that he'd told these people he was bringing a famous rapper from America to come and rap in their talent show. He had demanded to be paid up front for doing so. And I, in my Timberlands, was that famous American rapper. "Screw you," I said. "I'm not going anywhere."
"Please, dude, I'm begging you. Please do me this favor. Please. There's this girl here, and I want to get with her. And I told her I know all these rappers. Please, I'm begging you."
"Dude, I'm not Spliffsta. What am I going to do?"
"Just rap Busta Rhymes songs."
"But I don't know any of the lyrics."
"It doesn't matter. These people don't speak English."
Ah, fuck. I got up on stage, and Tom did some terrible beatboxing. Boof, boof, psh, boof, 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 psh. While I stumbled through some Busta Rhymes lyrics that I made up as I went along. The audience erupted with cheers and applause. An American rapper had come to Hammanskraal. And it was the most epic thing they had ever seen. So, that's Tom. One afternoon, Tom came by my house and we started talking about the dance. I told him I didn't have a date, couldn't get a date, and wasn't going to get a date.
"I can get you a girl to go with you to the dance," he said.
"No, you can't."
"Yes, I can. Let's make a deal."
"I don't want one of your deals, Tom."
"No, listen, here's the deal. If you give me a better cut on the CDs I'm selling, plus a bunch of free music for myself, I'll come back with the most beautiful girl you've ever seen in your life, and she'll be your date for the dance."
"Okay, I'll take that deal because it's never going to happen."
"Do we have a deal?"
"We have a deal, but it's not going to happen."
"But do we have a deal?"
"It's a deal."
"Okay, I'm going to find you a date. She's going to be the most beautiful girl you've ever seen, and you're going to take her to the matric dance, and you're going to be a superstar."
The dance was still 2 months away. I promptly forgot about Tom and his ridiculous deal. Then he came over to my house one afternoon and popped his head into my room.
"I found the girl."
"Really?"
"Yeah. You have to come and meet her."
I knew Tom was full of shit. But the thing that makes a con man successful is that he never gives you nothing. He delivers just enough to keep you believing. Tom had introduced me to many beautiful women. He was never dating them, but he talked a good game and was always around them. So when he said he had a girl, I didn't doubt him. The two of us jumped on a bus and headed into the city. The girl lived in a rundown block of flats downtown. We found her building. And a girl leaned over the balcony and waved us inside. That was the girl's sister, Lerato, Tom said. Come to find out, he'd been trying to get with Lerato, and setting me up with the sister was his way in. Of course, Tom was working an angle. It was dark in the lobby, the elevator was busted, so we walked up several flights. This girl, Lerato, brought us into the flat. In the living room, was this giant, but I mean really, really enormous fat woman. I was like, "Oh, Tom, I see what you've done here. Nicely played." Tom was a big joker as well. "Is this my date?" I asked.
"No, no, no," he said. "This is not your date. This is her older sister. Your date is Babiki. Babiki has three older sisters, and Lerato is her younger sister. Babiki's gone to the store to buy groceries. She'll be back in a moment."
We waited, chatted with the older sister. 10 minutes later, the door opened, and the most beautiful girl I have ever seen in my life walked in. She was, good Lord, beautiful eyes, beautiful golden yellow-brown skin. It was like she glowed. No girl at my high school looked anything like her. "Hi," she said. "Hi," I replied. I was dumbfounded. I had no idea how to talk to a girl that beautiful. She was shy and didn't speak much either. There was a bit of an awkward pause. Luckily, Tom's a guy who just talks and talks. He jumped right in and smoothed everything over.
"Trevor, this is Babiki. Babiki, Trevor."
He went on and on about how great I was, how much she was looking forward to the dance, when I would pick her up for the dance, all the details. We hung out for a few, and then Tom needed to get going, so we headed out the door. Babiki turned and smiled at me and waved as we left. "Bye."
"Bye."
We walked out of that building, and I was the happiest man on earth. I couldn't believe it. I was the guy at school who couldn't get a date. I'd resigned myself to never getting a date. Didn't consider myself worthy of having a date. But now, I was going to the matric dance with the most beautiful girl in the world. Over the following weeks, we went down to Hillbrow a few more times to hang out with Babiki and her sisters and her friends. Babiki's family was Bedi, one of South Africa's smaller tribes. I liked getting to know people of different backgrounds, so that was fun. Babiki and her friends were what we call Amapuchwa. They're as poor as most other black people, but they try to act like they're not. They dress fashionably and act rich. Amapuchwa will put a shirt on layaway, one shirt, and spend 7 months paying it off. They'll live in shacks wearing Italian leather shoes that cost thousands. An interesting crowd. Babiki and I never went on a date alone. It was always the two of us in a group. She was shy, and I was a nervous wreck most of the time. But we had fun. Tom kept everyone loose and having a good time. Whenever we'd say goodbye, Babiki would give me a hug, and once she even gave me a little kiss. I was in heaven. I was like, yeah, I've got a girlfriend. Cool. As the dance approached, I started getting nervous. I didn't have a car. I didn't have any decent clothes. This was my first time taking out a beautiful girl, and I wanted it to be perfect. We'd moved to Highlands North when my stepfather's garage went out of business, and he moved his workshop to the house. We had a big yard and a garage in the back, and that became his new workshop, essentially. At any given time, we had at least 10 or 15 cars in the driveway, in the yard, and out in the street, clients' cars being worked on and old junkers Abel kept around to tinker with. One afternoon, Tom and I were at the house. Tom was telling Abel about my date, and Abel decided to be generous. He said, I could take a car for the dance. There was a red Mazda that we'd had for a while. A complete piece of shit, but it worked well enough. I'd borrowed it before, but the car I really wanted was Abel's BMW. It was old and beat up like the Mazda, but a shit BMW is still a BMW. I begged him to let me take it. Please, please, can I use the BMW? Not a fucking chance. Please, this is the greatest moment in my life. Please, I'm begging you. No. Please, no. You can take the Mazda. Tom, always the hustler and the deal maker, stepped in.
Braebi, he said, I don't think you understand. If you saw the girl Trevor is taking to the dance, you would see why this is so important. Let's make a deal. If we bring her here and she's the most beautiful girl you've ever seen in your life, you'll let him take the BMW.
Abel thought about it. Okay, deal. We went to Babiki's flat, told her my parents wanted to meet her, and brought her back to my house. Then, We brought her around to the garage in the back where Abel and his guys were working. Tom and I went over and introduced them. Abel, this is Babiki. Babiki, this is Abel. Abel smiled big, was charming, as always. Nice to meet you, he said. They chatted for a few minutes. Tom and Babiki left. Abel turned to me. Is that the girl? Yes. You can take the BMW. Once I had the car, I desperately needed something to wear. I was taking out this girl who was really into fashion, and, except for my Timberlands, everything I owned was shit. I was limited in my wardrobe choices because I was stuck buying in the shops my mother let me go to, and my mother did not believe in spending money on clothes. She'd take me to some bargain clothing store and tell me what our budget was, and I'd have to find something to wear. At the time, I had no clue about clothes. My idea of fashion was a brand of clothing called Powerhouse. It was the kind of stuff weightlifters wear down in Miami or out at Venice Beach. Baggy track pants with baggy sweatshirts. The logo was a cartoon of this giant bodybuilding bulldog wearing wraparound sunglasses and smoking a cigar and flexing his muscles. On the pants, he was flexing all the way down your leg. On the shirts, he was flexing across your chest. On the underwear, he was flexing on your crotch. I thought Powerhouse was the baddest thing in the world. I can't even front. I had no friends. I loved dogs. And muscles were cool. That's where I was working from. I had Powerhouse everything. The full range. 5 of the same outfits in 5 different colors. It was easy. The pants came with the top. So I knew how to make it work. Bongani, the other middleman from my CD business, found out I had a date. And he made it his mission to give me a makeover. You need to up your game, he said. You cannot go to the dance looking the way you look. For her sake, not yours. Let's go shopping. I went to my mom and begged her to give me money to buy something to wear for the dance. She finally relented and gave me 2,000 rand for one outfit. It was the most money she'd ever given me for anything in my life. I told Bongani how much I had to spend, and he said we'd make it work. The trick to looking rich, he told me, is to have one expensive item. And for the rest of the things, you get basic, good-looking quality stuff. The nice item will draw everyone's eye, and it'll look like you've spent more than you have. In my mind, nothing was cooler than the leather coats everybody wore in The Matrix. The Matrix came out while I was in high school, and it was my favorite movie at the time. I loved Neo. In my heart, I knew I am Neo. He's a nerd. He's useless at everything, but secretly, he's a badass superhero. All I needed was a bald, mysterious black man to come into my life and show me the way. Now, I had Bongani, black, head-shaved, telling me, "You can do it. You're the one." And I was like, yes, I knew it. I told Bongani I wanted a leather coat, like Keanu Reeves wore, the ankle-length black one. Bongani shut that down. No, that's not practical. It's cool, but you'll never be able to wear it again. He took me shopping, and we bought a calf-length black leather jacket, which would look ridiculous today, but at the time, thanks to Neo, was very cool. That alone cost 1,200 rand. Then we finished the outfit with a pair of simple black pants, suede square-toe shoes, and a cream-white knitted sweater. Once we had the outfit, Bongani took a long look at my enormous afro. I was forever trying to get the perfect 1970s Michael Jackson afro. What I had was more buckwheat, unruly and impossible to comb, like stabbing a pitchfork into a bed of crabgrass. We need to fix that fucking hair, Bongani said. What do you mean? I said. This is just my hair. No, we have to do something. Bongani lived in Alexandra. He dragged me there, and we went to talk to some girls from his street who were hanging out on the corner. What would you do with this guy's hair? He asked them. The girls looked me over. He has so much, one of them said. Why doesn't he cornrow it? Shit, yeah, they said. That's great. I said, what? Cornrows? No. No, no, they said. Do it. Bongani dragged me to a hair salon down the street. We went in and sat down. The woman touched my hair. shook her head and turned to Bongani.
I can't work with this sheep, she said. You have to do something about this.
What do we need to do?
You have to relax it. I don't do that here.
Okay. Bongani dragged me to a second salon. I sat down in the chair, and the woman took my hair and started painting this creamy white stuff in it. She was wearing rubber gloves to keep this chemical relaxer off her own skin, which should have been my first clue that maybe this wasn't such a great idea. Once my hair was full of the relaxer, she told me, "You have to try keep it in for as long as possible. It's going to start burning. When it starts burning, tell me and we'll rinse it out. But the longer you can handle it, the straighter your hair will become." I wanted to do it right, so I sat in the chair and waited for as long as I could. I waited too long. She told me to tell her when it started burning. She should have told me to tell her when it started tingling, because by the time it was actually burning, it had already taken off several layers of my scalp. I was well past tingling when I started to freak out. "It's burning! It's burning!" She rushed me over to the sink and started to rinse the relaxer out. What I didn't know is that the chemical doesn't really start to burn until they're rinsing it out. I felt like someone was pouring liquid fire onto my head. When she was done, I had patches of acid burns all over my scalp. I was the only man in the salon. It was all women. It was a window into what women experience to look good on a regular basis. Why would they ever do this? I thought. This is horrible. But it worked. My hair was completely straight. The woman combed it back, and I looked like a pimp. A pimp named Slickback. Bongani then dragged me back to the first salon, and the woman agreed to cornrow my hair. She worked slowly. It took 6 hours. Finally, she said, "Okay, you can look in the mirror." She turned me around in the chair, and I looked in the mirror, and I had never seen myself like that before. It was like the makeover scenes in my American movies, where they take the dorky guy or girl, fix the hair and change the clothes, and the ugly duckling becomes the swan. I'd been so convinced I'd never get a date that I never tried to look nice for a girl, so I didn't know that I could. The hair was good. My skin wasn't perfect, but it was getting better. The pustules had receded into regular pimples. I looked not bad. I went home, and my mom squealed when I walked in the door. "Ooh, they turned my baby boy into a pretty little girl. I've got a little girl. You're so pretty. Mom, come on, stop it. Is this the way you're telling me that you're gay?" "What? No. Why would you say that? You know it's okay if you are." "No, Mom, I'm not gay." Everyone in my family loved it. They all thought it looked great. My mom did tease the shit out of me, though. "It's very well done," she said. "But it is way too pretty. You do look like a girl." The big night finally came. Tom came over to help me get ready. The hair, the clothes, everything came together perfectly. Once I was set, we went to Abel to get the keys to the BMW. And that was the moment the whole night started to go wrong. It was a Saturday night, end of the week, which meant Abel was drinking with his workers. I walked out to his garage, and as soon as I saw his eyes, I knew he was wasted. Fuck. When Abel was drunk, he was a completely different person. "Ah, you look nice," he said with a big smile, looking me over. "Where are you going?"
"Where am I? Abe, I'm going to the dance."
"Okay, have fun."
Can I get the keys?"
"The keys to what?"
"To the car."
"What car?"
"The BMW. You promised I could drive the BMW to the dance."
"First, go buy me some beers," he said.
He gave me his car keys. Tom and I drove to the liquor store. I bought Abel a few cases of beer, drove back, and unloaded it for him. "Okay," I said. "Can I have the BMW now?"
"No."
"What do you mean, no?"
"I mean, no. I need my car tonight."
"But you promised. You said I could take it."
"Yeah, but I need the car."
I was crushed. I sat there with Tom, and begged him for close to half an hour.
Please,
no.
Please,
nope. Finally, we realized it wasn't going to